You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Chris Lopez here. And today I've got Lucas Miller in the studio. And I actually had asked Lucas to come in here to talk about what he's currently doing for his real estate investment strategy. So if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, this is not the first time you've heard Lucas. This is actually his third time on the podcast. Right. He was on one of the very early episodes talking about his house hack, which was a duplex in Inglewood, Colorado.
Right.
And then, I don't know, quite a few episodes after that, he came on to talk about the legislative process here, the way it works here in Denver, which if you like politics, if you like learning how that stuff works, it's a great episode. I'll link to both of those in the show notes. And then most recently, Lucas was one of the contributors in the new book we just published called The 2019 Guide to Denver Real Estate Investing. And so Lucas wrote about what he does as a multifamily syndicator. So I wanted to bring Lucas back in here to talk some details about syndication because I know the very big overview of it, the very high-level overview, but I don't understand the details of it. I don't understand the types of returns people get. I get people ask me all the time. So I asked Lucas to come in here. Lucas, thank you, man. Good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for being a great resource and putting the book together. I was really happy to contribute and be a part of it. It was an honor.
Well, I'm glad you contribute. So let's talk about what you've done and then why you're doing syndication. We'll talk about that as like what you're doing as the syndicator, as like kind of like the business you're doing, and then also what it looks like for investors since there's different aspects to it. So did you start out in real estate investing with house hacking or flips?
House hacking. And we did flips too. And I say me and my wife, but back in that first episode, that was probably like
long ago,
2014, 2015, early 2015, maybe, or maybe mid 2015. But anyway, so we started with a house hack. That was the very first investment purchase I made. And, you know, it really opened the eyes to what you could do with real estate investing and how to make it a business. And back then I had no real intention of turning it into a full-blown business. It was just more of a strategy to avoid some of the Denver rents. But now it's turned into this big new thing and everybody's doing it. And it's awesome. I think it's great. So the next step for us was really flipping. And flipped a few condos and it worked out really well for us. We made a bunch of money, not through skill, but just through appreciation in Denver. But we started to think like, okay, what's the next step? And the next step was long-term wealth creation, just like everyone wants. So back in that first episode that we talked about, I think I at that point, I was looking out of state for some more units. Wanted to scale up to have, you know, instead of a duplex, maybe 5, 10, 20 units. And obviously need a little more capital here in Denver to do that. And out of state, you have a little more leeway there. So started looking at that and quickly realized that, and this is my point of view, but it's harder to do that than some of the bigger stuff. And so,
you say the bigger stuff, what do you mean?
Commercial size, like large, which is what we're doing now, like 100 plus unit buildings.
Okay.
And we can get into that too, but started to really run up against a lot of hurdles, mainly being out of state. You know, there's out-of-state investing is the big thing here in Denver because prices are high and it's difficult to find great deals, not impossible at all. But so everybody's interested in out-of-state investing. And so one of the biggest hurdles I found was the financing aspect of it, which is so critical to an investment property.
And let me clarify something here. So when you were first looking at, was this to start as a syndicator, or is this when you were just looking to sell your duplex house hack to just pick up more units?
Yeah, just to pick up more units. I really avoided syndication for like a year because I had a misconception that if I'm syndicating, I have to share the profits with everybody and I don't want to do that. Like, I want that for myself. And it's not a misconception in that you do share profits, but and we can get into it, but the returns are much greater, and it allows you to scale without having, you know, 20% of a $10 million loan. So, you know, there's a lot of pros to it. So I started out just looking to buy as many units as I could for as much cash flow as I could get. And I found it to be pretty difficult going out of state looking at commercial properties.
And you were looking Kansas City, was it?
Yeah, Midwest. I mean, Kansas City was a great market that I'm still looking at it actually, but much, much bigger properties now. But Kansas City, Oklahoma, a couple of Midwest areas.
Okay. And so is the way I'm understanding this is that as you start searching for properties for just to place your profits from the duplex you sold here in Denver, is that what kind of led you into syndication to look for bigger deals then?
Yeah, to a point. I mean, obviously I was, so to back up a little bit, I've been, for my day job, I was working for some large commercial multifamily owners and developers. And so kind of got hooked up with a guy there who was just killing it. And he was a younger guy. He was buying these million-dollar properties. And finally, I just asked him, you know, how are you doing this? And so he kind of ran me through. And I didn't know it was called syndication at that point. It was just group investing or pooling money. And he kind of walked me through, well, here's how you do it. And so I knew about it, but I just figured, nah, I don't want to share the profits, you know. Plus, I don't want to have to go through the hassle of raising money or anything. So, you know, moving forward, I started to realize, like, that's not a downside to this. That's really a pro. You get to raise money from people and allow them to diversify, allow them to achieve their financial goals and utilize their money to help you scale, too. So, you know, it's a really big win-win.
So the duplex you sold here in Englewood.
Yeah.
Did you end up buying a small apartment building with that, or did you end up rolling that into a syndication?
Yeah. So that's a pain point. So let's get into that.
let's start the therapy.
Yeah. So obviously had quite a bit of equity built into that duplex. We put a lot of sweat equity into it. So had a big capital gains bill when we went to sell and found...
You couldn't do the capital gains exclusion?
We did we initiated a 1031 exchange.
Okay,
so we had the 45 days to identify and then I think another 45 days to close. I can't remember the exact rules, but so we actually found the deal first. It was 11 units in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so initiated the, you know, it was easier to sell a property here than to find a property out of state. So we found the property mm-hmm. first before we started the 1031. Sold the duplex and started that process and eventually found out that, you know, it was a really good deal and it probably still is a good deal. But it just needed a little more work than we were anticipating. I saw it in person and we went to have the due diligence stuff done, like sewer scopes and inspections and all that. And so the sewer scopes came back pretty rough and the lender really just didn't like it. It was a small community bank. They didn't like the area. I thought it was a really good area. You know, seeing from Denver, you can see the trends. Like, look at, you know, the Colfax area. A really mm-hmm. artsy district. 10 years ago, it was pretty rough. You know, same with Rhino, maybe 15 years ago. So it's easy to see that trend, but the lender just didn't like it. And so they changed terms on us right before closing. So it was a 6% loan, 25-year AM, and 25% down.
Okay. And what was like, it was like a 5-1 ARM?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. He changed that with like 5 or 10 days to closing. It was crazy. And so
what did it change to?
6.25% rate on 20-year AM, which was ended up killing it, and then 30% down.
Wow, so everything went up.
Oh yeah, everything across the board. And I found out later, like a lot of that is due to me not being on the ground. Like a small community bank here, you can create that relationship, walk in, see him face to face. And you could do that out of state, but yeah, everything else I could have swung. 6.25% was terrible. We could have done it, but and the 30% down, we had a ton of equity, so we were happy to put more down. But the 20-year AM just killed our returns. And so we ended up paying tax on that. We missed the 1031 deadline, which ended up, you know, everybody wants to say you know, I don't want to pay taxes, but I'd rather pay the tax bill than buy a bad deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we took that money and then put it into a large commercial investment as a passive investor, which worked out really well for us.
So you were just the passive investor in someone else's syndication.
Yep.
Is now, was this before or after or during? Like, when did you becoming a syndicator get on your radar?
It was at the same time. Like we were running in parallel. So I knew I wanted to get into syndication and I knew I wanted to do it, but I needed to place this money. I had to do something with it. So we were running in tandem and I figured I'd just buy this 11 unit building and then I'd move on to syndication. That didn't work out well, but I had a ton of money just sitting in a bank account. So I figured, let's just put it into someone's deal. And so It worked out pretty well. It was a large 300 plus unit building in Memphis and in a really great area, really good returns, and been pretty happy with it so far.
So I want to talk to you about returns on syndications because I don't understand the deal structure. So I don't know if you want to talk about this deal or save that for a little bit later.
Well, we can speak. Let's do high level syndication returns.
Okay. Could you mind kind of sharing just the basic return structure that you got from the money you invested?
Yeah. So high level return structure and syndication, again, is just a fancy word for group investing. And so it's been around for a long time. You find a big building, several million dollars. One person doesn't necessarily have the money to do a 25% down payment, plus the rehab dollars it might take. So what they do is they go out and raise money from private investors. And those people are called limited partners, the passive investors. The main active investors are called general partners. And so the limited partners put in money. It is limited in scope. They don't get a whole lot of voting rights. And you can expect almost totally passive investment, which is the main driver of why people like it so much. I mean, it's once the money is wired, there's very few ways to get out of it. So, you're passive whether you want it or not. And the active role, which is what I do, is...
Let's pause on that for a second. I want to kind of segment those things to actually dive down the passive stuff. So what's the typical... Let's say I invested $100,000 into the syndication you did a couple years ago when you were a passive investor. So I invest, say $100,000 for easy numbers. What type of return could I expect or what type of deal is in the prospectus?
So, I'm going to use that cop out. Every deal is different, but my deals are generally speaking somewhere around 10% cash on cash return. And we use a metric in commercial investing, which might be unfamiliar to some people who just do residential, but it's called internal rate of return, IRR. And essentially that is a return on investment metric that takes into account time value of your money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that's important is these are usually 5 to 7 year holds. These are longer period holds. And your returns are going to be different at each year, basically. So if you buy a building that's not really performing very well, your returns that year are going to be lower. And then once you add that value, it's going to be higher. So the time value of your dollar is taken into account with the internal rate of return. But just easy metrics are, we like to double investor returns in 5 to 7 years. So if you put in $100,000 in year 5 to 7, depending on when we sell it or refinance, you will get back $200,000.
Okay.
And that is through cash flow and through proceeds from sale or refinance. So if you had $100,000 you invested, which is typical, 75 to 100 grand is typical for a limited passive investment in a syndication. Year one, let's just say for easy math, it's a 5 year hold and every year is going to be the same. So in year one, you get $10,000. Year two, you get $10,000. So in year five, you will have gotten $50,000. And then let's say you sell it that same year and you get another $50,000. You're getting $100,000 back in profit. So that's the idea of it.
So can you do the IRR in your head on that?
Well, the IRR is...
I'm asking that jokingly because the calculation of IRR is
It's probably around 15%.
It is a screwy thing, or it actually takes a spreadsheet to do like thousands and thousands of computations by default to whittle down and figure it out. So it's very hard to do it in your head. That's why I'm kind of busting your chops here.
And
just so our listeners know.
15% IRR, which is typical for my deals. I don't know how it is for everyone else. I do a very specific subset of C-class value add properties that are, you know, we could drill down, but 15% IRR is usually doubling your money in about 5.5 years. So it's a good metric to know that if your deal is being held for 6 years, you should expect a, you know, 2% equity multiplier, which is doubling your money.
And that, is that pretty, I mean, I know every deal is different, but is this kind of a similar thing based off of, you know, typical syndications out there?
For the value add C-class property space, that's pretty typical.
Okay.
So if you're investing in Denver right now in an A-class building, a brand new build, you're paying much more per unit, obviously, and your returns are much lower. But the benefit to, and usually the people that are doing that are institutional buyers, meaning Wall Street, pension funds, life insurance companies. Their capital is cheaper, so their money is cheaper. So their returns might be slightly less because their capital costs less and their returns are lower. So,
well, they can borrow for like 3% on Wall Street.
Right.
Like, yeah, there's exactly. No way we can do that.
No.
I wish.
Yeah, I wish too. So my capital is more expensive, and so we demand a higher return structure. And that is pretty typical of any market you go to. If you're buying a C-class property anywhere in America, you should expect to get at least those metrics.
Okay. So kind of going back to the sample deal. So I invest $100,000, and then given the 10% cash on cash return, is that basically an annual distribution that's done, or annual dividend? I don't know what the correct term is. Or is that all held till the end?
So if you're a limited partner, and again, each syndicator will do this differently. Some do monthly cash flow, some do quarterly. I do quarterly cash flow, and it's just either direct deposited or send a check.
Okay.
I mean, it's very simple. And that's your cash flow. So, and we have another complicated metric on top of that, which is, it's called a preferred return. Ours is usually 8%. The preferred return is the first 8% that the property generates, 8% profit, goes directly to the investors.
And when you say profit, is that your net operating income?
The first 8% of rental profit, yeah. So out of your NOI, that first 8% goes directly to the investors. That means we don't profit share. We, meaning the active investors, don't profit share on that first 8%.
Okay.
And so that is call it a security blanket or something to incentivize investors to feel a little more comfortable about the deal. Some people mistake that, like, oh, I'm only getting 8% return on my money. No, that's just the first 8%. Everything above that, so that ninth percent, that's when we usually split it 70-30. So 70% of that dollar, or 70 cents of that dollar, goes to the investors, 30% or 30 cents goes to me.
Okay. And that metric is calculated in the, what you're saying, the 10% cash on cash return and about 15% IRR?
Yeah. Okay. So we won't put a deal under contract unless all of our fees, all of our, and we use rules of thumb for like closing costs and things. All of that needs to be built in before we even submit an offer. So if we have something under contract, we will get paid, investors will get paid, and you should expect that that's all built into your offer. Some people don't, which I can't fathom how they get those deals past people, but they don't advertise their fees, like sponsor fees. I can't imagine not being compensated for my work right away, but some people don't.
Okay.
There's pitfalls to that too. So
what's the downside risk
of being a passive investor?
Yeah, being a passive investor. So I mean,
losing your money.
Yeah, but I mean, because I'm assuming you're talking about C-class value add property, so that's going to be mostly forced depreciation by coming in, remodeling a place, changing management, bumping up rents.
Yeah,
and not so much market dependent appreciation.
Yeah. It, I mean, commercial properties are valued on how much they how much money they bring in.
Yeah.
So you can call it forced appreciation, but it will be mostly like is when people say forced appreciation, a lot of time people think, oh, I'm just going to rehab a bunch. In multifamily, it can be that, but it can also be, you know, we're cutting management costs and really streamlining things. That's going to save us 1% here. We're going to increase the NOI because we're going to charge for trash removal or build back some utilities or things that every dollar you increase in your NOI usually equates to about $16 in valuation. And that's at a 6 cap. So that's a good rule of thumb. So every dollar I save adds $16 to my value.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is, the downside risk is, and people like, and this is one of my pet peeves, people like to paint this rosy picture of syndication like, oh, you know, it's recession proof. There, nothing can ever go wrong, you know. No, it happens all the time. The downside risk is you will lose your money if things don't go well. And that's why picking your sponsorship team is probably the most critical thing you can do as a limited partner or a passive investor. They are correct in saying like multifamily is the safest investment you can make, assuming everything is structured correctly. But your sponsorship team can either make or break that investment, and they can take a bad deal and make it okay. They can take an okay deal and make it really bad.
So as a limited partner in this fictitious investment, I put $100,000 of my Monopoly money in.
Okay.
I'm limited. It's kind of like the stock market. I can never lose more than I put in, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That is correct. And
that's me as a passive investor.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that is really important to note because one of the most common questions I get is like, am I going to be, you know, foreclosed on? Are they going to come after my assets? No. And that just doesn't happen, at least in the structure I do. And I can't think of a structure where anyone would go after a limited partner. You're limited in that scope because of some of the SEC guidelines, the Securities and Exchange Commission. So as a sponsor, we have to file some paperwork with the SEC that basically says, hey, this is an unregistered security that we're selling. You need to do your own due diligence on this. And so the investors know going into it that the most you can lose is your principal unless you do like a capital call or you ask for more money and you lose that too. But yeah, no one's going after your assets.
Okay. And so, that's the downside risk. And I'm assuming, you know, this is out of the scope of this podcast on how to analyze it and how to figure out those sponsors.
Yeah.
I know that's a whole different game. It takes a lot of due diligence.
Yeah.
But it's like anything. And I always like, hey, what's the upside? What's the potential downside? Because that's the reality with everything in investing and actually pretty much with life is there's pros and cons. So I really, I'm glad that you shared that. So I'm really curious, since you might not be able to answer this, are there like industry stats or averages as far as like, you know, how many deals go sideways or investors lose money? And I just ask this because I've talked to quite a few like hard money lenders around town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most hard money lenders are great. And there's a few that will just lend on crappy properties so they can foreclose on the property and kind of the investor loses a bunch of money, but then the hard money lender gets money back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, you know, obviously if there's like a high foreclosure rate for the hard money lender, that's a big red flag because you don't want someone, oh yeah, we foreclose on like 10% of our properties. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Don't lend on them. Are there any type of stats, rules of thumbs you see in syndication?
You know, I've heard, and multifamily, large commercial multifamily is incredibly safe from foreclosure rates. That's the closest thing I can think of is...
Why is that?
It's run more like a business than a rental property. During the great financial crisis, I think foreclosure rates on residential mortgages was around 4%. On multifamily, it was 0.4%. So it was much lower. But, and a big caveat to that is not all of those were making money. That just means that the bank didn't foreclose on them. So investors in syndications might not have been making money on those deals, but they didn't go so far south. Now, what I do is, and what I'm focusing on right now is buying deals with long-term debt. For residential, that's 30 years. For commercial, like large deals like this, that's 10 to 12 year debt, amortized over 30 years. In our interest rate, we're closing on a deal next week that is 4.6 or 4.7%. So very low cost money. And that's a 12-year note amortized over 30 years. So that gives you...
And that's fixed for 12 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
4 years of interest only, too.
So that gives you the grace period to go in there and...
That is literally the best product that available.
I've never heard of a four-year interest only loan.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of 2 years.
Started as 3 years, but we got another 4 years. And so that's a roundabout way of answering your question is, this is a Fannie Mae product.
Mm-hmm.
And... They're Fannie and Freddie are the number one lenders of large commercial multifamily, and at least I think so. Anyway, so they have a vested interest in making sure these properties perform really well. So they do their own underwriting, they do their own inspections, and if they're signing off on something as low cost as that, I mean, they're the biggest investor in your deal. They're at 80%, 75%. So they have a vested interest in seeing that work out. They don't want to foreclose on properties because they're not in the business of operating apartment deals. So there's a lot of comfort in that for investors too. But just like in residential, there are some hard not necessarily hard money, but they're bridge lenders. And that's where I see people getting into trouble right now is buying these large value add properties on bridge loans and assuming they can add the value and force the appreciation to refinance into longer term debt. And if the window is closing on, you know, the multifamily, large multifamily space, like if there is some sort of market correction coming, your valuation is based on prevailing cap rates and it's based on, you know, stuff that you can't necessarily control. So if you're doing a deep value add, you might not be able to refinance out of your property.
And bridge loans are usually 12 months or less, right? Is that the way it works in commercial?
No. We did a bridge loan earlier this year on a property in Memphis that was 3 years, but we got 2 1-year extensions that we can buy into.
But so for a total of up to 5 if you need it.
Yeah.
Okay, but you'll pay some points to extend it or?
Percentage points, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But our interest rate was crazy low. It was like 5.7 or 5.8 for that, which on a bridge loan, you know, that's really unheard of. So we felt pretty comfortable with that. That's close to agency money, meaning Fannie and Freddie. So felt pretty comfortable with that. But if it was like 10, 12%, which some are, I wouldn't touch that right now.
And that's got to be a lot tougher to make the numbers work.
Especially for someone who doesn't have experience doing it, which some people do. Like, you know, it's not hard to find multifamily right now where you need to spend $10,000, $20,000 a door to get it operational. And Fannie and Freddie won't lend on a property unless it's 90% occupied, 92% occupied and performing well. So you got to add that value to get that up there real quick and then you can refinance. But I don't know. Some people might get into trouble with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like anything. You gotta
again. That goes back to your sponsor.
So let's shift gears here because you did a great explanation of just talking about what it looks like, kind of just the overview, and then what it looks like from a passive, you know, as a passive investor and mm-hmm. structuring those returns. And the other side of the coin is not being the investor, but it's being the syndicator or sponsor, things like that, which is, you know, something you got into the last year or two.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, it seems like now, and I know if this is reality or just the way I'm seeing things, seems like people becoming syndicators or syndications are the kind of like one of the hot new careers in real estate. Like every fifth person I meet is a syndicator now. So I always like to distinguish because, like, oh, I want to like do this or do that. And I consider, hey, nothing wrong with being the sponsor syndicator, but that's not investing. That's a business.
Oh yeah,
and that's, you know, that's very different from, hey, I'm going to just invest $50,000 or $100,000, whether it's a rental property or passive investing. It's kind of like fix and flipping.
Yeah,
I consider fix and flipping
a business or a job, whatever you want to call it, because it's active. If you're not doing stuff and making things happen, you're not getting a return. So what made you want to become a syndicator? Why was that the best route for you and your family to kind of build up your rental portfolio and, you know, build towards retirement? What drew you there?
Well, I have never really liked the idea of being just a simple passive investor. I'd like to get there someday, but I know I'm not the type of person to want to just buy rental properties and then sit on a beach. I really enjoy the idea of building a business. And so syndication fit that bill really well. And I figured, I'll just become an active syndicator for a little while until I build up that portfolio. But what I found is that I really enjoy this job and my career way more than I thought I would, which is really cool for me. So but make no mistake, it is a full-time job. You know, I know I've got a couple of partners that have full-time jobs, but they are much more senior. And ironically, both of them are engineers, but they're much more senior in their jobs than someone just starting out.
And like they have a full-time day job, as an engineer or whatever.
Yeah.
And they also do
but they have deals
on the side.
But what I'm getting at is they have a ton of leeway in their jobs. You can't do this job with a 9-to-5 job. I mean, I'm on the phone constantly, just like you are. You have to fly to on-site places. You have to meet with property management companies. At the drop of a hat, a broker this morning said that they were in town for an event here. And so I said, I'll just pick you up at the airport and take you to your hotel. Like, you can't build those relationships and get that pipeline of deals and operate on a high level if you're dealing with, a 9-to-5 job that you hate.
And probably. This is a broker that is in another market that you're building relationships with.
From the East Coast.
Yeah.
And to me, that was way more valuable than whatever I was doing, just because, I spend $1,500, $2,000 flying to a different market, hotel room, rental car, all that, just to meet with these people. So you got to make sacrifices, and it costs a lot of money, frankly. Syndicating is great. You can do it with no money, with the big caveat that it's incredibly difficult, just like flipping or, wholesaling. Like, you can get into it technically with no money, but it's difficult.
Let me ask you this. What would be, let's just say, come to you and say, hey, Lucas, I'm doing a career change. I want to become a syndicator. I want to get into this model. What advice would you give me? Because I know there's, the amount of work that's involved, the money involved, and then, lack of a better word, just like there's a financial runway you need, because, I'm not going to become a syndicator tomorrow and do a deal next week. Nothing ever goes that quick. Other than, I'm sure it's like winning lottery. There's always that 1 in a million person that comes aboard and 30 days they hit their first syndication, but that's not typical.
That's nuts.
What does it take to actually go out there and build that business? 6 months, a year, 2 years? I know a lot of it depends, but just some generalizations.
I'd say 6 months on the very minimum to get you up to speed to know, basically what you're talking about. And I know a guy that he underwrote like 126 deals, which to underwrite a property, it's, it takes probably an hour or 2 hours if you're doing it a very light valuation. So he did 126 of those before he got his very first deal. And so you're talking 6 months just to get to a point where you would feel confident to put in an offer on a property. Properties take like 45 days to close. You're talking like a year before you would probably realistically have your very first deal. And that's assuming you can go into it and build a relationship with commercial brokers that quickly. That's the biggest hurdle, is finding a good deal. You can go on LoopNet and find deals, but they're not good deals. And you really got to build a relationship with those brokers.
I'm going to just interject here, because this is a good difference people know, because you're talking commercial world, and usually we talk, residential stuff on this podcast, four units and less. And, the vast majority of residential properties, trade on the MLS.
Right.
But from my understanding, from talking to different commercial brokers, the vast majority of commercial deals trade off, off LoopNet, which is kind of like the commercial MLS. It's all about, hey, the broker will get a listing or they'll have a firm client want to sell a property and they shop it around their clients to then kind of do the buy and the sell side.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of it comes from just relationships, right?
Yeah. It's the closest correlation is like someone like a wholesaler. If you've got a lead on a property, you know, two or three people max that you could take this to and they would buy it if it fit their, you know, priorities. And so you kind of shop it around those one or two people. Most of the commercial brokerages that I talk to are like 50% on market, 50% off market.
Okay.
If it's on market, that doesn't mean it's on LoopNet. That means they've sent it out over an email blast to their subscribers.
They put together their marketing materials and blasted it.
Right.
Okay.
If it's off market, they haven't put anything like that together. They're like, hey, this seller's thinking about maybe selling. They're entertaining offers. We don't have anything other than, you know, maybe the last 3 months financials. Would you be interested? And so you got to kind of extrapolate from that on what you could pay for it. And, you know, that's the biggest thing is just building that relationship with brokers and proving to them that you're serious. And I don't know how to do it. Back to your original question, I don't know how to do that when you're just starting out unless you partner with someone that's been doing it before.
Okay. How have you developed relationships?
Partnerships.
Okay.
Yeah, just people who have done it before. And eventually you get to a point where you can you know, answer the broker's questions to a point where they would feel confident in you. But without that, you just have to be in the market.
Would you say it's a fair assumption or fair statement to say it's much harder to build a good relation with a commercial broker than as a residential broker?
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Commercial brokers are, how can I say this politely? They're very picky usually about the clients they work with.
Yeah, right now, probably 15 years ago when the market was in the tank, you could like sneeze at a commercial broker and they'd send you the best listing they have. But now it's like multifamily is the hot new thing. Everyone's buying it. So they get to be picky and like they get picked up from the airport from schmucks like me. Like, and they get taken out to lunch all the time and coffee. So it's, you know, it's very much a sales game.
Yeah.
But they are picky.
Okay. All right. So going back, so we were talking about, before I came off that side tangent, expect about a year. So I would say, just expect to pay, you got to pay your own bills for a year before you can expect money. And then as the syndicator, you make money from the investment and also some acquisition fees,
yeah,
or like putting the deal together fees.
Yeah,
sure there's more official words than that.
No, that's pretty good. Yeah, so there's a few fees. Like, so to start, if you think of the deal as a equity pie, my deals are usually 70% go to the investors, 30% go to the general partnership team. That's usually made up of two or three, four people. And from that, you have an acquisition fee, which is usually somewhere around 1% to 2% of the purchase price. And you know, a lot of people balk at that. Like, they don't like you making money, mostly because they know how much you're making. But it's kind of the fact that, well, you're investing with money that someone paid you for. You know, someone paid you for your work. That's the same thing with us, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's usually an asset management fee, which is an ongoing, like, management fee to basically stay on top of the deal. Deals aren't lost in the first year when things go to hell. Some are, I'm sure. But it's like year three, year four, when you start to take your foot off the gas and let things slip and slide. And that's when deals start to fall apart. So you want that asset management fee. You want that person making money for the long term so that they stay, you know, accountable to the property. And then obviously when you sell it, you get 30% of that fee, assuming your preferred return is met. Well, and just to go back to your original question, you're talking about a year just to get up and running. That does not take into account the ability to raise money, which is a whole nother animal to syndication. Is you're only as good as how much money you can raise. So you can go after $20 million properties, but if you can only raise $100,000, you're not going to close. So that's a whole nother topic in and of itself, is legitimizing yourself to the point where someone trusts you with $100,000 of their hard-earned money. So,
and plus, I mean, so other than, I always like to kind of, I always view things as different hats. So one hat you're wearing is developing relationships with brokers and whoever, so you can find deals that fit your requirements. Another hat is doing the underwriting of, like, you know, because that's a skill set. That's just learning and repetition and a lot of time behind the computer. And then eventually walking properties, all that stuff. Another hat is then raising the money, which is probably building relationships with investors and educating them and doing whatever you want. And then there's a lot more compliance.
Oh yeah,
because you're dealing with the SEC, and this is an investment, investment vehicle or investment product. I don't know what the term is, but I sat in a year or two ago. I sat in some like lawyer talking about, and you know, she went through like four different ways of raising money. Yeah. I was lost by about minute 10, but it's very interesting because, you know, all these rules for this type and this type and this type, and then what you can and can't say and how you advertise it. Like, there's a lot of, like, you got to know what you're doing.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, people could really get into trouble if you get involved with someone who's never done this before, because, and I say get into trouble, meaning you could lose your initial principal. I mean, that, again, going back to our original question of how much can you lose, the syndicator, on the other hand, can get nailed to the wall with felonies if you do it wrong. So learning that is important, but, you know, that's why I developed a team around me of people that are good at one thing. Like, I've got one guy that I do deals with pretty regularly. He's really good at underwriting. That's his skill set. My skill set is more of the due diligence, walking properties, making sure things are done correctly, marketing, raising money. And
marketing to raise money.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a whole nother... And without getting too much into it because of the SEC, like, there are rules to that too. You can only do so much. So you really got to build a team around you with different skill sets to make sure you're doing it well for your investors too. You have a fiduciary responsibility to, don't try and do it all by yourself because you're going to fail at something. You know, it's just, that's just how it is. And so learning what you're good at and what you're not good at and finding people to compliment, that's important.
Oh, I agree with that statement. Yeah. Play to your strengths and partner up on things that are not your strengths. Okay, so what, because I get people a lot of time asking, you know, as we're talking and they're getting to real estate, some want to do investing, whether it's syndication investing or rental investing or whatever investing. Other people want to get into, like, I'll say a career that leads to investing. So fix and flipping, being an agent, being a syndicator, things like that. So what little soundbite can you give to people? Say, I want to get into syndication. What would you recommend as far as a reality check and say, hey, look at this, this, and this, and this?
Yeah, so I spend my days underwriting deals, talking with brokers, desperately trying to raise money, and constantly hitting your head against the wall, talking to brokers because they're sending you the same crap deals everywhere. It's not as glamorous as cashing $100,000 checks every week. Like,
you don't get a big giant check every
week? No, I mean, if you're serious about wanting to get into syndication, understand that it is not passive in the least bit. And I've seen a few things like on Bigger Pockets or something where people are like, oh, I want to become a syndicator and get that passive income. And it's like, that's not how it works.
Well, it can after 5 or 10 or 15 years of grinding it out, I would imagine.
You could, but it's still not passive. Like, if you're honestly dead set on making sure your assets perform to their maximized ability, that takes every single week on the phone with your property manager, visiting your properties quarterly, making sure your property management company is not skimming money off the top. Like, it takes a level of detail that you know, you really don't understand until you're there. And I think a lot of people like the idea of putting these big deals together. But if you're just looking for money, there's easier ways to make money in real estate, honestly. Like, go flip houses. That's a nice big check. And
so you would consider flipping houses easier than syndicating?
No, gosh, that's a good question.
Well, I know it's very different.
I would say you don't need nearly as much resources to flip houses as you do to syndicate.
Okay.
Meaning you don't need partnerships necessarily. You don't need, and I guess I can say that because I've done both, but I've never really done flipping well, so maybe I'm wrong. But I just consider them different enough to where, like, if someone's like, hey, I need to get in and make $100,000 a year in real estate somehow, should I syndicate or should I flip houses? I'd say go flip houses. Because if that's your goal, the large income, then you need to do that. You need to do a lot of deals to get $100,000 a year in passive income or cash flow income. You can get that in an acquisition fee, but you got to do everything really well. You got to be able to raise a lot of money. You got to be able to find the deal, underwrite the deal. But yeah, I know.
And plus, you got to subtract your expenses from the acquisition fee as well for all the cost associated, right, yeah, which, yeah, you know, that's not just the time. It's that there's a lot of costs and expenses involved in stuff.
I do know a guy that made $100,000 his first year syndicating, but I think that was like 2010 or 11. So deals aren't as readily available anymore. You got to work harder. You got to compete a lot more with a lot of different people. So take it with a grain of salt.
Got any final thoughts or things we share before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I talk to a lot of people who have no idea what syndicating is, which, I mean, that's totally fair. But a lot of people who want to get started in real estate, maybe they're later in life or maybe they just have a really good job that they like, provides them a good income, and they're like, oh, I'm going to buy rentals out of state. And I'm like, I can save you some time. You know, I can get you pretty close to the returns you would make investing out of state. Definitely not in state. Like, I can't touch flipping houses or buying, you know, a really good appreciating asset here in Denver, but I can get you pretty close to a turnkey property, if not better. But the benefits from syndication really come from the tax savings, and which we didn't even touch on, but you can, through a lot of different tax strategies, and of course, you know, talk to your accountant, but you can really maximize your returns through some cost segregation and some other things that you really can't get necessarily on that scale with out-of-state rentals. So if you're considering out-of-state rentals or you like the idea of getting quarterly checks or monthly checks without doing a ton of work, look into it, but do your due diligence.
Wonderful. All right, so let's see here, Lucas. So I know I got a couple of things we're going to wrap up with here. So before we get into how people can get in touch with you, I know you recently launched a podcast. I mean, within the last couple of months or so, right?
Yeah.
I forget the title. Something geared towards syndication. So what is it and how can people get it?
Yeah, so it's called Fear-Free Passive Investing. And so a lot of what I do is talking with people who are curious about passively investing. And I started answering the same questions over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, the broken record syndrome.
Yes. And I found that a lot of them are just rooted in fear. People are scared of losing money, which is completely legitimate. Yeah. And so the idea behind the podcast is to put actual faces to people who have passively invested before, what they were feeling, what they used to overcome their fears, and kind of get an idea of what they were thinking. And so that's the idea behind it. We have, I think we just did our 10th episode, which is cool. But yeah, and what I like about it is I'm happy to ask questions that people email me to guests. So if you have questions and that you want, you know, an objective third party to answer, shoot me an email.
And so your podcast is called Fear-Free Passive Investing.
Yep.
So I'm sure if people
type in the podcast or whatever they can, or the podcast app they can find.
Should be everywhere.
And then what's the website so people can look at it? And I'm sure your contact details are on there, right?
My company is called Bannock Capital. And that was a throwback to our first duplex that we bought. It was on Bannock Street. So www.bannock, BannockCapital.com.
Awesome. Lucas, thank you. I learned a lot, so I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Now I can speak much more knowledgeable about how syndications work. So thank you, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.